This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast featuring weekly interviews with the most brilliant minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is always free of charge, and unlike the mainstream financial press, we are not a platform for market cheerleading. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the business telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Macro Voices episode 14 was recorded on May 12, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Professor Steve Keen will be joining me as today's feature interview guest. We'll review some of the ideas that were discussed in our last two feature interviews. We'll compare and contrast how those views relate to the various different schools of economic thought. And then we'll dive into Professor Keen's prescriptions for what reforms are needed to prevent another catastrophic financial crisis. But wait, there's more. After our feature interview with Steve Keen, we're going to announce some format changes that we have planned, and we even have a special surprise second guest joining us for a short interview. So if you don't already know what hashtag OOTT is, we're going to tell you all about it before the show's over.
And I am Nathan Egger. Welcome back, everybody. Eric, last week I observed that the chart was looking pretty grim for the S&P 500, but you countered that it wasn't yet time to go short because the S&P was still trading above its 50-day moving average, and you thought it looked like, you know, a nice setup for a bounce. And it was looking like you called that one perfectly, at least initially, but what are you seeing now?
Well, I'm seeing what I expected. I was not necessarily expecting a bounce to new all-time highs, but there's always going to be at least a little bit of support on a major moving average. I figured that we would get at least a bounce. It would last for however long it lasted, and eventually we would break down below that level. If I'm going to put a short on, I'm going to wait for a daily close below the 50-day moving average. We may still get it today because, as I expected, we had that bounce off the 50-day. It lasted a couple of days, and it looks like maybe by the end of Thursday's trading session, will be there. Daily close below the 50-day, I will definitely consider putting a short on at that point. And the reason for that, number one, Bank of America Merrill Lynch reported this week an all-time record 15-week consecutive series of institutional net selling by their institutional clients. So in other words, as we evaluate what the big money is doing, they're selling. Now, they're selling into a rally. When does that happen? The final stages of a bull market, when the smart money is selling what they're holding to retail investors. That's number one. Number two, Carl Icahn reportedly 150% net short equities. That was reported by Zero Hedge this week. Now, it's interesting. I've been to a pitch meeting for Carl's fund. I've met Carl. He is normally an activist investor. He looks for companies with corrupt management or problems that he can solve by changing their management. And he has a very specific style. He doesn't usually take really large, outsized, directional macro bets. So Carl Icahn is so concerned about the state of the market that he's 150% net short. Holy cow, that's a big position, especially considering it kind of amounts to style drift based on the charter of his fund. George Soros reportedly levered up now with put options on S&P 500 futures. I do want to be short here. Frankly, I've lost a bit of money recently being wrong on the oil trade, so I'm going to wait till I see a little bit of a stronger indication that the sell-off is really on. The breakdown below the 50-day moving average, which I'm sure is coming, I just don't know how long it's going to take to get there, will probably be the trigger for me.
And speaking of oil, we've seen plenty of volatility in crude, but it just looks like the market is having a tough time making up its mind. So what do you think is moving prices this week?
Well, first of all, we don't want macro voices to turn into crude oil voices. I'm sure it's probably sounded that way, but the news flow has been just so overwhelming in the last few weeks, and it's really been overwhelming this week. So it'll be another long one. Please bear with us, folks. I'll try to be as short as I can. Big news out of Saudi Arabia this past weekend. Saudi Arabia fires its oil minister, Ali Al-Naimi, who has been in that position for more than 20 years, replaces him with a new guy, Khalid Al-Fali, which I'm probably mispronouncing. Most observers are reporting on this story in the context of, okay, so who's the new guy? How does his view differ from the old guy? What can we expect? I don't think that's the right way to look at this story. The story here is not about the new oil minister. The story is about another guy, Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He's often referred to, by the way, as just MBS. MBS is the 30-year-old prince, and until now, most people outside the Saudi royal family kind of had the impression that, okay, Al-Naimi is maybe not a prince, he's not royalty, but he's been in that position for a long time. He has the king's ear. The 30-year-old prince, obviously he's royalty, that's very important in that culture, but he's not really in power. It's become really clear now. MBS just fired this guy because he doesn't like it. So I think the story is mostly about the rise to power within the Saudi royal family of Mohammed bin Salman. So what we need to ask ourselves is, why did he fire Al-Naimi? Was the reason because he listened to Macro Voices last week and heard me say that Saudi Arabia shouldn't have allowed the price to rise as much as it has? And what MBS wants is to get the price back down in order to do a more effective job of prosecuting this agenda, which I believe Mr. Al-Naimi was the originator of? Or is this, I'm firing him because this whole plan of his didn't work and we never should have tried to suppress the price. We should reverse our strategy and fire this guy and get somebody else. All indications so far are it's the former, that they want to continue the strategy, the market share strategy as it's been called, and I think that that primes the pump potentially for some next moves out of Saudi Arabia to try to jawbone the market lower. But it could be that it's for different reasons, so we really don't know. But if you want to look at this issue, it's about MBS, Mohammed bin Salman. It's not about who the new oil minister is. Let's move on. Fort McMurray situation, perhaps under control, in the sense that they appear to have saved about 90% of the city. For a long time, what people were thinking is, okay, the oil-producing assets are not really at risk. They're 30 kilometers away from the fires. We don't have to worry about that. But if the whole town burns down and there's no place for the oil workers to sleep, then we can't possibly run those assets. Well, there were horrible destruction of a couple of thousand homes in Fort McMurray, and our hearts definitely go out to the listeners that we have that were displaced by that. But in terms of, will this shut down oil production? No, it looks like the production outages are already starting to be corrected, and within a couple of weeks, they'll be back up to normal production. Nigeria, however, has lost about 400,000 barrels per day due to militant activity and attack on a pipeline. Venezuela, meanwhile, has a whole different problem, which is that the failure of socialism is so bad there that the state-owned oil company can't pay its bills. Foreign contractors are pulling out, and they're losing production capacity. You could see if there was an actual societal collapse in Venezuela, which a lot of geopolitical observers think is very possible. You could see the entire country taken offline, not because of military conflict, but just because their economic state of affairs is so screwed up that they can't continue to do the most important thing for them to do, which is to produce and sell oil. So that situation is going to be very interesting to watch. If it falls into an outright societal collapse, civil war, whatever, Venezuela is probably the most oil-rich country in the world. That would be huge. In general, though, the speculative longs, according to the Commitment of Traders reports, are starting to give up. It looks like maybe we are starting to see a topping process, at least in terms of market internals. A lot of empty crude oil tankers departed the Houston Ship Channel last weekend. Now, it's hard to tell from that data because we don't know whether or not they were unloaded on Friday or unloaded on Saturday. So does that oil, just a whole lot of oil, hit Houston last weekend? Was it going to come in this week's inventory number or next week's inventory number? Looks like next week's inventory number, because this week's inventory number surprised everybody. There were expectations initially of about a 1 million barrel build on inventory, an increase on national inventory. But then API, the American Petroleum Institute, on Tuesday afternoon reported expectations of a 3.5 million barrel build. That started to send the price down. When the official government data came out, it was actually a 3.5 million barrel drawdown on inventory, a 7 million barrel discrepancy from what expectations had been just before, and that sent the price skyrocketing $3 higher to new cycle highs. Next week, I can see a lot of good reason for there to be a huge surprise in the DOE inventory report. Drum roll, please. Are you ready for which direction? I have no clue, because we've got this huge flow of oil into Houston. That should result in a very large increase in inventory. On the other hand, we're going to see the brunt of the Canada fire-related loss of production in the inventory numbers this week. which one is going to outweigh the other one? I don't think anybody knows, and my suggestion is be ready for anything to happen when inventory occurs next week. The real story, though, I think, is not about national inventory. It's Cushing, Oklahoma inventory. And again, the reason that's important is because it's the settlement location for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures Contract. Look at it this way. The 1.5 million barrel build on inventory, even though it was a national drawdown, we still had a 1.5 million barrel build on Cushing inventory. We just used up 20% of the remaining spare storage capacity in Cushing, Oklahoma, in 1 week. Five more weeks of that would go to a complete crisis situation that would put oil prices into the teens, guaranteed. Is that going to happen? Remains to be seen. Certainly, technicians looking at the price say new cycle highs are possible, so I think we probably have not seen the most of this oil rally. If we had the right confluence of events and the Cushing inventory numbers continue to increase at the rate they did this week, we will have a storage crisis and we will have a price crash. The thing is, Canada may be what bailed us out, because remember that all that oil going into Houston from ships overseas, that doesn't go into Cushing inventory. That goes into PADD 3 inventory. Where does the oil from Canada go? A lot of it goes to Cushing, Oklahoma. So we've got a real problem. The crunch and the place that you have to watch out for that could crash the market is Cushing, Oklahoma, and it's not going to be receiving as much oil from Canada now as a result of the fires. So that does change my views. As Lord Keynes famously said, when the facts change, I'm forced to change my opinion. I think that there is a huge, huge wild card with Mohammed bin Salman. If this guy fired Al-Naimi because he thinks Al-Naimi was not aggressive enough, certainly MBS has shown the world already that he is willing to make very bold statements and do unexpected things. If he wants to aggressively try to jawbone the market lower, I think he can do it, and I think he could be very effective. I wouldn't be surprised to see something next from this man. On the other hand, we don't know what his motivations are. Maybe he has decided that this whole strategy was wrong. So far, I'm kind of leaning in the side of watch out for a wild card from him that pushes prices lower, not higher. Canada is definitely something, though, that could take the pressure off of Cushing, Oklahoma, and that could undo my whole bearish thesis. Just the Canada by itself, the Fort McMurray and that area of Canada produces somewhere between 1 and 1.6 million barrels per day of oil. That's enough to totally neutralize the whole situation that Art Berman and I have talked about if it were to stay offline. It's not going to stay offline. It's going to come back online. But maybe it was offline for long enough to avert the crisis that I've feared, and maybe seasonality will come into play again. We'll see what happens. Point is, you don't know, and until we get some more data, I feel like I have no choice but to stay on the sidelines.
We've also been watching gold continue to gradually back off from that high that was just a hair under 1306, made back on May 2nd. Where do you see the gold market headed next, Eric?
Well, you know, we did see some really nice-looking separation. I call it space above the line. The bottom of the trading range on a given day is visibly well above the 50-day moving average. That was last week. We've come back to this week to where we, I think, just almost kissed the moving average on Wednesday, and looks like we're above it again today, but still kind of hugging the line there. The big question, I think, for gold, though, is all about the U.S. dollar, as we discussed last week. If the dollar rally, or I should say, if the dollar correction, assuming that that's what it is over and the dollar is just going to rally from here, I think that it's going to mean bad news for gold. On the other hand, if we saw the dollar move to new lows, say a dollar index below 92, I think that gold would really take off to the upside. I want to be clear, too, for our retail listeners especially, my long-term view on gold is and always has been extremely bullish. I think it's going to several thousand dollars per ounce over the next 10 years, and that is based on my prediction that we've got a lot more quantitative easing and money printing coming. So my bearish views on oil that I've expressed are really intended for traders who are trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next few weeks. With respect to the long-term picture, I definitely think it's much higher. If you're a retail investor, you don't yet own gold. You know, down here in the less than 1500 range is a good place to be buying it. Just don't be surprised if you get an opportunity, and I would say save some dry powder for that opportunity if it comes, to buy some more below 1,000, because I think that's entirely possible, especially if the dollar rally continues.
So you said last week, Eric, to keep a close eye on the dollar index, particularly if it were to drop below that 92 level again. How's it looking?
Well, I've been doing a lot of thinking about the dollar over the last week, and here's my conclusion. If the conspiracy theories about this Shanghai Accord, a secret meeting by government to weaken the dollar, a conspiracy of several different central bankers that supposedly occurred on February 26th, if that is false, then I am absolutely with the dollar bulls. I think all of the fundamental analysis that I can see says this was a correction, it's probably ended, and it's all up from here for the dollar. The thing about conspiracy theories, though, is sometimes they get proven to be conspiracy facts, and that could be the case here. If we see the dollar move back down below 92, that's going to say to me, okay, something's up. There's something outside of the fundamentals that I can't see. Maybe this Shanghai Accord thing is real. I don't know. But the fundamentals have changed in a way that I cannot account for if this is not over yet. So what we've seen is a very nice persuasive bounce that looks like it could be the beginning of a bottoming pattern and that maybe we're going much higher from here on the dollar index. But really in the last couple of days was the first time we got to the upper side of that channel, what we call channel resistance in technical analysis. Right now, we're not breaking through channel resistance. We're sitting right on the short-term channel resistance. I want to see it move again above that. If we go in the other direction and it rolls over from here, something's up, and I'm going to start to look for this conspiracy theory to maybe start to have some facts behind it.
Eric, 2 weeks ago, when you interviewed Richard Duncan, he opined that governments should seize this opportunity that's been presented by this deflationary backdrop and print trillions of dollars and then invest that money in technology companies so that we can both advance the economy, but also society as a whole. Then last week, you interviewed, and I'm going to mess this up, Ajit Das. But that interview sounded much more critical of government rather than suggesting that government could actually provide the cure for what ails us. So how is it possible that two recognized experts could have such diametrically opposing views on the same subject matter here?
Because economics isn't really a science, even though they claim it is. It's the study of the effects of imposing a specific economic ideology on society. And generally speaking, the people who are doing the so-called objective research are generally very heavily invested in their own views. So fiscal and monetary policy will forever and all time be dictated by people who have a strong vested interest in their own economic ideology. That's just politics, and it's how the way the world works, whether we like it or not. So when you hear opposing views from experts like Richard Duncan and Das, I'm not going to try to take the first name on, dude. You're more daring than I am. That's perfectly normal. It almost makes you want to look up your old economics professor from college and ask them to help you dissect on how to understand each different expert's viewpoint and maybe even map those to one of the prevailing schools of economic thought, such as Keynesian, neoclassical, or even Austrian economics.
Well, why settle for an economics professor when you can get the department head instead? Professor Steve Keen heads up the School of Economics, Policy, and History for Kingston University in London. He's also one of the very few mainstream economists who saw the 2008 crisis coming and accurately predicted what would occur. Eric's interview with Professor Keen is coming up next as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
In the 8 years since the 2008 financial crisis, literally thousands of economists have weighed in with post-facto opinions as to what caused it. But very, very few can say that they saw it coming and accurately predicted what would happen and why. Professor Steve Keen is one member of that very exclusive and small club. Professor Keen now heads up the School of Economics, Politics, and History for Kingston University in London. Professor Keen, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Our regular listeners have heard two separate interviews on essentially the same macroeconomic subject matter over the last 2 weeks. One with Richard Duncan, who believes that governments should be seizing the opportunity to use further quantitative easing to make massive government-managed investments in technology. And the second one was Sujit Das, who, frankly, his interview sounded more like an indictment of government as the cause of all of our problems. Now, economics isn't a hard science, and the only way that I can equate how it's possible that two experts could have such diametrically opposing views is because there are several different prevailing schools of thought. My experience is, though, a lot of people throw words around like Keynesianism, but really don't have a very accurate understanding. So I'd like to start, if we could, with a comparison. What are the prevailing schools of thought in economics? And if possible, how do they explain how two different experts could have such diametrically opposing views?
Well, there's the dominant school of thought in economics is called neoclassical economics. Ironically enough, a lot of people who are neoclassical economists will deny that they are when you tell them that they are. Because the neoclassical school is divided into two major forks when it comes to how they analyze the macroeconomy. If you're familiar with the writings of Paul Krugman, he refers to one school as the freshwater economist, the other as the saltwater economists. And what they share in common is a belief that capitalism is a system which tends towards equilibrium, that is fundamentally a barter system in which you can normally ignore the financial sector, and certainly you can almost always ignore banks. And the differences they have is that what they call the freshwater school is a pure neoclassical school that believes the economy is always in equilibrium, even during events like the Great Depression, which they say was caused by workers deciding to take an extended holiday. I'm not joking. And the saltwater mob, who argue, well, there are various frictions that slow down the perfect working of the market mechanism. So if those frictions weren't there, then the freshwater crowd would be right and the economy would always be in equilibrium. But because there are frictions like trade unions, government spending, people's slow reactions, relatively slow reactions to some external stimuli, they say the economy can be out of equilibrium, but it's always tending back there again. So that's the dominant school. The two major groups that oppose that are Austrian economists on one side. You might call that the right-wing side, but I think it's not necessarily right versus left. And the other, the post-Keynesian school. And the Austrian school are people who believe that capitalism is a system which tends towards equilibrium, but its strengths come from how it behaves in disequilibrium. So they emphasize that the economy is always out of equilibrium, and that gives opportunities for entrepreneurs, and that's what gives capitalism its motive force. And they tend to blame sustained problems on the government sector, where they say the government's created too much money, caused a bubble, et cetera, and they're against what they call fractional reserve banking. Post-Keynesians are people who argue that what was called Keynesian economics by people like Paul Krugman actually owes far more to Paul Samuelson than it ever did to Keynes, and ignores all the, to some extent, Austrian attitudes that Keynes had about instability, uncertainty, and the role of the market in coordinating incomplete and totally small packets of information and making it possible to make sensible decisions. But the post-Keynesians argue that capitalism can fall into a permanent slump caused really by the financial factors, which the mainstream neoclassicals completely ignore. And that's largely the perspective that I come from. Of course, Hyman Minsky is the person who's my main inspiration, and he to some extent straddles the Austrian and the post-Keynesian perspectives.
Now, something I was fascinated to learn about economics is that there's actually disagreement on issues as simple as whether or not credit counts as part of the money supply, or perhaps not technically the money supply, but the amount of available money in the economy. It's hard for me to understand how something that fundamental wouldn't fit or be agreed upon. Is that true? And which schools feel which way? And what's your view in terms of the role of credit in the economy?
That's absolutely true. And it's really because economics is more a set of competing religions than it is anything even resembling a science. And the two dominant perspectives are that it's tending towards equilibrium and it's effectively a barter system, and that it's always in disequilibrium, and that it's a fundamentally a monetary system. Now, to hold the first set of beliefs, that's what the mainstream, with both the saltwater and the freshwater sides of it, they both hold to that view. And to hold to it, they have to argue that you can ignore banks, ignore debt, and ignore money when analyzing the macroeconomy, except for taking into account the role of increasing government money supply and causing inflation. That's their mental frame set. It is totally and absolutely at odds with the real world, and it frustrates the hell out of me that I've got to waste my time even discussing it. But that's the mainstream view. So the minority view, which is that credit is absolutely essential and creation of money by banks plays a fundamental role in macroeconomics, that's largely the province of the post-Keynesian school that I'm part of.
And I'm curious, too, because this is something that, as I understand it, at least in the mainstream schools, they really do not account for the concept of inventory. There's this analysis of supply and demand and so forth. Mm-hmm. I trade crude oil myself. The economic school of thought, as I understand it, is entirely about supply and demand without any consideration of how much oil is being held in inventory or how much spare capacity exists to hold more of it, which to me is central to what happens to oil prices. Am I correct in understanding that the major schools don't even recognize that?
Yeah, you are. And it's bizarre for me as well. I mean, I've had a few instances of they give nice little cameos for that. I mean, I remember having a conversation with the New Zealand Central Bank and the Treasury, because at that stage the Treasury Secretary wanted to use my Minsky software to build a dynamic non-equilibrium monetary model of the New Zealand economy. He was blocked by his own economics staff, and he couldn't persuade that it was a useful thing to do. And in that discussion with the economic staff, I was trying to persuade them to at least try, you know, some different angle as opposed to their normal equilibrium fixated modeling. One of the staff said, look, I walk down the street and I see markets clear. And I said, so you walk past Star Yards every night and you see that they're empty, do you? And he said, huh? And I said, well, if you're right, markets clear, there'd be no cars left over in the car yards every night. There'd be no products left on the shelves of the supermarket every night. That's what you mean by clearing. The flow of demand will always be equal to the flow of supply, because for every buyer, there's a seller. But the flow of production may exceed the flow of demand, and therefore you're going to get a rising stock, is what we've seen in the case of oil. And if you don't include stock dynamics in your thinking, you're going to be completely wrong in analyzing where the market is headed. And you'd think they'd be realistic about the markets, but this obsession with the intersecting demand and supply curves, as if it's defining economics, makes them think that that's where all the action is in a market. Whereas even if you use that, I think, pretty nonsensical abstraction as a way of modeling dynamic processes like the markets, when the price is such that supply exceeds demand, you're going to get an increase in stocks and vice versa. And that's an essential part of how you should think about real-life markets. But because their model excludes these dynamics, they ignore inventory almost completely.
Now, you've been an outspoken critic of the mainstream neoclassical school of economics, and I think you get a lot of credibility and recognition because you're one of very few people who saw the 2008 event coming. So I'd like to really focus the rest of this interview on your prescriptions for what's wrong with neoclassical economics, how it needs to change, and particularly how central bank policy and government policy in general needs to adapt. But I'm sure our listeners are curious to know, how did you see 2008 coming? What was your perspective that was different from everyone else that allowed you to see something that very few economists saw on the horizon?
Well, fundamentally, I'm informed by Hyman Minsky's financial instability hypothesis. And if anybody wants to follow up on that, do not buy his book, Stabilizing an Unstable Economy. Buy his book of readings instead called Can't It Happen Again, which is far better written and far more concise. So in reading Minsky back in 1987, I regarded that as the first really, I thought, coherent overall analysis and critique of capitalism that I'd ever seen. A lot of left-wing critics of capitalism come from a Marxist background, and they'll talk about a tendency for the rate of profit to fall and this tendency for stagnation in capitalism, which just sounded like nonsense to me. And whereas Minsky talks about capitalism having a tendency towards euphoria, and his basic argument was that you'll have a If you have a period of tranquil growth in capitalism, that's actually the exception. The rule has been a crisis, which has occurred just beforehand. And in the aftermath of the crisis, everybody's conservative about the amount of leverage they'll take on, both banks, lenders, and borrowers. But as you recede from the crisis, people tend to forget the crisis occurred, and a period of stable growth leads to rising expectations, which therefore leads to a higher willingness to borrow, which then drives up investment and stimulates the economy, and you get a cycle coming out of that. But the cycle tends to lead to firms taking on debt to finance investment during a boom, and then having to repay some of that debt during a slump. And consequently, you get a tendency for the level of debt to ratchet up over a series of trade cycles until you finally get a level of debt where it simply is so great that the system can't reset and reduce the debt and go back for another cycle again. You simply have a black hole of debt phenomenon occurs. So that was my basic mental picture. And for my PhD, I wrote a mathematical model of Minsky's hypothesis. He hadn't managed to produce one himself. And one curious side effect of that model was, and not predicted by Minsky's theory at all, was that before the crisis, there'd be diminished cycles. It'd be what economists later named the Great Moderation. So informed by that model, when I looked at the debt data, an essential part of this model was a rising level of private debt to GDP. I looked at that model and looked at the data. The data had all the characteristics my model predicted back in 1992. And looking at it 2005, I saw that the level of private debt in America was the highest it's ever been and growing basically an exponential growth in the debt ratio from 1945 on. And I thought, this can't be continue. At some point, the rate of growth of debt has to slow down. And when that rate of growth of debt slows down, which is fundamentally where credit comes from, the economy will go into a serious recession, the worst it's had since the Second World War.
Now, as I understand you, one of your criticisms of neoclassical economics is that adherence to that school would have left someone unable to make the prediction that you made. So what's wrong with neoclassical economics that would prevent someone who only subscribed to that school of thought from seeing what you saw back before the 2008 event?
Oh, God, it's almost like they'd be wearing marble glasses 2 inches thick. They're not even looking at the important data, even though the statistical agencies record it. So they completely ignore private debt. That's not even part of their thinking. And you read Bernanke on that. Bernanke is supposedly the expert on the Great Depression. Dismissed Irving Fisher's debt deflation theory on the argument that a debt deflation is no more than a redistribution from one group to another group. Now, it's absurd, that comment's absurd in its own right, but it means he simply ignores the level of private debt. So they don't even look at the major signal. That's indicating a problem, because as far as they're concerned, debt is a transfer from one non-bank agent to another non-bank agent, and the person who lends has less spending power, but the person who borrows has more spending power, and the two cancel each other out. And that's their argument for just ignoring the level of debt completely. And when I model that, which I've modeled their fantasy in my software package Minsky, and when I do it, you know, they're quite right. If the lending is from one bank to non-bank to another non-bank, it just redistributes the existing amount of money. It doesn't create any extra money, and it doesn't create any extra demand. But as soon as you acknowledge that, gee, guess what? Banks actually lend money. And when they lend the money, people who borrow that money spend it into existence. You don't actually have, you're not liable to a debt until you actually execute the capacity to create the money that the debt contract gives you. When you spend that money, you add to demand as well. And of course, if you have declining credit, that's actually taking demand out of the economy. So they're completely blindsided to the most important causal factor in the dynamics of capitalism. That's why they didn't see it coming. And they still can't understand why it happened. And they're still floundering around trying to explain why growth is not occurring now, when exactly the same causal factors behind it. We have very low credit growth, and that's why we have a stagnant economy.
Professor Keane, you're working on a new book now titled Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? And my understanding is that's almost a rhetorical title. Your point really is to express some criticisms and perhaps prescribe some reforms that may be needed in order to avoid that crisis. Am I correct in understanding that that's what the book is about? And then, by all means, tell us about the book, because I think our listeners are very interested to know what needs to be fixed.
Yeah. Oh, it's a book actually has an interesting title. It could be a one-word book, as you're saying. It could, the single word no could be the total content. But it's a 25,000-word book, which is quite short by academic publishing standards. It's just a particular format that my publisher has chosen that I quite like. So in 25,000 words, I have to explain why we have got the zombie economies we have around the globe. And what I explain is fundamentally that countries like America, obviously, England, Spain, Greece, Portugal, that are in a long-term slump right now, and Japan, the oldest of all the zombies, are debt zombies. They took on too much private debt. They are in the aftermath. They have failed to address private debt as the cause of the crisis. So the debt's still at very high levels by historical standards. There's no great increase in the level of debt, therefore credit is extremely anemic, and that's why all these countries are zombies. But I'm also identify about 15 other countries that are likely to be the next bunches of debt zombies, and of course that includes China. And when you take a look at those countries, we've got about, comparing them to the size of the USA, the countries that are liable to suffer a debt crisis in the next 1 to 3 years are equivalent to slightly larger than the American economy. So we're in for another crisis, not in countries like America and England themselves directly, because they're zombified. You have to have a large amount of credit growth to have a credit crisis when it slows down. But you have stagnation coming out of it. So they're going to be stagnant. We're going to have a crisis in China, crisis in Australia, Canada, Sweden, Norway, and a few other countries, including Korea. And that's going to mean, of course, for the zombie country, the growth they're getting from exports will itself decline. So, crises are going to be the order of the day, and they will be until we reduce the level of private debt.
You mentioned this idea of zombie countries, essentially describing a country that's had so much trouble with debt that it will be difficult for its economy to recover. I would kind of like to know whether the country I'm living in at any given moment is on the list. Is there a way to tell which countries? Is there one de facto indicator that tells us who is a zombie country?
Yeah, well, there's a combination of indicators. First of all, it's the level of private debt compared to GDP. The higher that level is, then the more susceptible you are to have a crisis. With a low level of private debt to GDP, like, for example, Germany, you're not going to have a domestic crisis. So that's the first thing, high level of private debt. By high, I mean anything over 1.5 times GDP. Second indicator is how fast has debt been growing in the previous 5 years, and that therefore tells you how much credit makes up of total demand. And this is working actually from work by an American philanthropist called Richard Vaig, who runs what he calls the Debt Economic Project these days. He was a banker and creator of credit card companies who then saw the crisis coming, got out of the credit card business, and is now campaigning against private debt. He did the empirical work to identify those two levels, and I've since verified it. So a country with a debt level of more than 1.5 times GDP, where that debt level has risen by 20% or more over the previous 5 years, is on its way to being a zombie. And countries which have already had that phenomenon and had the rate of credit slow down and turn negative are the zombies. And America is clearly in the zombie class. It had a debt bubble that took private debt from about 90% of GDP in about 1990 to 170% in 2009. And when the rate of growth of that debt started slowing down in late 2006, that's when the American crisis began. Now, a country like Australia, which managed to avoid the crisis by pretty much encouraging the private sector to go back into borrowing money again through a couple of housing schemes they pulled, that avoided the crisis phenomenon, but it's now got to the stage where its private debt level is about 210% of GDP, and the increase in credit last year was equivalent to 15%, or the increase in debt, which is credit, was equivalent to 15% of GDP. So all you have to have a crisis is the rate of growth of that debt slowing down. It doesn't even have to go negative. And that will be such a major reduction in credit demand that the economy will suffer a recession. And countries like Australia and Canada are clearly lined up for that, as is China and also Korea.
So what are the specific reforms? If you were in charge of everything and could dictate government policy, what needs to change in order? I guess you said you don't think that we can avoid another crisis, but in order to mitigate the effects and put us back on the right track, what needs to change?
We have to reduce the level of private debt. That's the bottom line. Government spending can counteract the depressing impact of low credit demand, but it can't eliminate it. And this is the situation Japan's been in now for one quarter of a century. So people focus upon the level of government debt in Japan and say that's what caused its crisis. In fact, that was a response to the crisis that attenuated its severity but hasn't ended it. So Japan has now had one quarter of a century of stagnant credit-based demand, compensated to some extent by government debt rising at the same time, but it hasn't got out of its crisis. I'll give you an idea of some numbers there. When the crisis hit in 1990, Japan's government debt ratio was 60% of GDP. Its private debt ratio was 210% of GDP. Its private debt ratio has since peaked at 220 and has fallen down to about 170% of GDP, where it's flatlined for the last 10 years, while government debt's risen from 60% of GDP to 220% of GDP. Now, it's still stuck in a crisis. It hasn't got out of the problem. So the only thing that could actually get you out of it is writing off that private debt. And you need to write it off in such a way that it doesn't destroy demand at the same time. So I'd be using the government's money-creating capacity to actually cancel that private debt, reset the whole system, but then make private debt a target of government policy. In other words, realizing capitalism has an innate tendency to generate too much debt, and then using the government's fiat money capacity to write that debt off as we used to do with our pre-capitalist nations, what we call jubilees.
So essentially what you're saying is erase the debt, and that gives the debtor a free lunch, and the creditor gets paid off with printed money, which presumably has a dilutive effect on the rest of the money supply. Is that essentially the picture?
Partly, but you can't do it just for the debtors. I mean, a lot of people have argued quite, you know, we were saying, look, there's a moral hazard issue. This means debtors always get rescued. Then you just generate an encouragement to get into debt again, which is quite true. So what I say we should actually use is there are two ways you create money in a capitalist economy. The banks lend more than they get back in repayments, which is the standard fashion, but of course that can give you a rising private debt ratio if the debt grows faster than GDP, which it historically has done. Or the government can run a deficit. The government, when the government runs a deficit, it spends more into the economy than it takes back in taxes. Those are the two ways we create money. Now, because the government owns its own central bank, it's possible for it to use that government bank money creation capacity to put money directly into people's private bank accounts. And my argument is we should do that irrespective of whether people are in debt or savers. So, but if a debtor gets the money, they have to pay their debt off, have to reduce their debt level. If a saver gets the money, they get a cash injection. So that means you can balance the depressing impact of writing the debt off by the stimulating impact of giving savers a bonus. It doesn't give debtors any advantage for having been in debt beforehand, and it also want to reform the financial system to prevent banks lending to finance Ponzi schemes, which is fundamentally what a housing bubble is and what, frankly, share market speculation is as well. So I think we need to do a whole range of reforms to control the one out-of-control element of a capitalist system, which is the financial sector. Unless we do it, we're going to be stuck in the situation Japan has been for the last quarter century without its social cohesion. And that, to me, is not a recipe for a peaceful capitalist America.
So to summarize your prescription, it's essentially helicopter money, massive money printing, that is shared equally by everyone, but with the rule that debtors must use that to pay off their debt, to essentially cancel debt, make it go away. And it sounds like a fascinating idea to me, but I'm a little bit troubled by one thing, which is every single thing I've seen out of central bankers since 2009 has been entirely this narrative, which is about how we need to get credit moving again so that consumers can borrow more and spend more in the economy. Are you optimistic? I mean, it seems to me like you're talking about a complete and total reversal. And it, as far as I can tell, what most mainstream central bank thinking is these days is we need more credit, and you're saying we need less. So I passionately agree with you. I wonder if anybody's ready to listen.
Not in the central banks. I've pretty much given up on them. And I'm now working with a number of private sector companies and entrepreneurs that see this as an opportunity to create parallel currencies. But they're saying the capitalist system has stuffed itself up for two reasons. One, the banks have funded Ponzi schemes rather than genuine investment. And two, the government doesn't understand the monetary system it itself is in control of and is actually encouraging private debt while doing all sorts of other stuff-ups as well. So maybe what we should do is have the private sector start creating its own money, because we fundamentally need money for transactions. And if you can get some way of backing private money so that people accept it as cancellation of debts and as payment for transfer of goods and so on, we can stimulate some economic activity out of it and maybe slowly teach the bureaucrats and the economists in mainstream government departments that this is how the world actually operates. So I've given up on the, even though like my reforms are all about government money creation in that sense, I think it's not going to happen. The entrepreneurs are going to see it more rapidly, and I'm going with private money creation, but not by banks.
Now, when you say private money creation, are you talking about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, or are you talking about other forms of currencies?
Other forms. I'm not a fan of Bitcoin because it was based on a false model that gold was money, and a false model of gold as well. It's far easier to create new Bitcoin-like technologies than it is to create gold. So in that sense, the analogy was false. It takes far too long to verify transactions. You could never have the capability to enable Bitcoin-style cryptocurrencies to take over normal transactions. But blockchain works, and if so long as you have a verified hierarchy of money, and convertibility between different forms of money, which is feasible, then you can have an electronic monetary system, which would be created by private sector and backed by private sector either assets or private sector obligations between units, verified in the same sort of way that the blockchain behind Bitcoin is verified. So it's feasible, but, and I think it's far, I'm far more likely to get success with the private sector than I am with the government, frankly.
Professor Keene, I think we could talk about gold and cryptocurrencies for an entire full-length interview. I'll look forward to doing that someday, but unfortunately, we are out of time. Before we close, tell us a little bit more, when is the new book coming out? Where can people get it? Is there a pre-order on Amazon? And in general, how can people follow your work?
Okay, I've been following my work. I have written an occasional column on Forbes, though the pressure of writing the book has meant I've written almost nothing for the last month. I also have my blog, debtdeflation.com/blogs. The book itself is being published by Polity Press, P-O-L-I-T-Y, and it should be out, I'm hoping, by October. I've got to finish writing the draft on the 30th of June, so it's a pretty tight schedule. But I think I'll get it out by the end of the year. I'll whack up pre-release, pre-sales on my website, and probably also link it through Forbes. So it should be possible to start making orders, I hope, by about September.
Fantastic. Well, Professor Keene, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Nathan Egger will be joining me as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger.
Great interview with Professor Keene, Eric. But now that we've completed our three-week series of interviews designed to contrast and compare the perspectives of different recognized experts, I'm sure our listeners might enjoy hearing your opinion as well. We certainly got some passionate posts, to say the least, in our listener discussion forum about these interviews. What was your take on these three interviews?
Actually, it was the listener discussion forum reaction that surprised me the most. What it seemed like is people wanted us to bring on an economist that we would agree with, or that everybody could really like what they had to say and feel like we got the guy who had the best prescription for solving the economy. If that was our goal, I would have asked you to call the Von Mises Institute and get three pure Austrian economics guys that we could compare and contrast their views on how to solve this. That would be a fun podcast. I'd enjoy being on that podcast if anybody wants me to do it on some other podcast that they produce. But that's just not what Macro Voices is for. The goal that I have and the way I think about this is what I think should happen for the world. I do that on my own time, and it is a passionate subject for me. But as a money manager, my job is not to think about what I think should happen for the world. I have to stay out of the should happen business and try to keep my brain focused on the what's likely to actually happen and what is it going to mean for markets business. And so for me, I'd say Richard Duncan was definitely one of the strongest interviews, if not the strongest that we did. Why? He's a guy that I couldn't possibly disagree more with in terms of how his views differ from mine. I don't think it's the job of the government to try to interfere with or control the economy at all. So obviously our views are diametrically opposed, but my job is to understand how the people who are actually in power think. Richard Duncan, definitely, his thinking represents the way the people that are in charge of the central banks think. And so it's very instructive for me, even though it disagrees strongly with my personal values, to listen to a guy like that who thinks the way the people that are in power think, because that helps me to understand what comes next. And I think, definitely, if you wanted to understand, okay, well, what drives those people in power, what shapes their thinking, a guy like Steve Keene clearly has the academic perspective on all the different schools of thought. He can compare and contrast all of the differences between these different economic models and help us to understand how these people think, even though he very strongly criticizes those views. It's clear that he understands it. So what I wanted the most from these interviews was not for somebody to agree with me, but for somebody to help me understand what I might expect to come next from the people that are actually in charge of all this stuff. And I would say that the combination of Richard Duncan and Steve Keene was most effective for me in that regard. I love Das. He's just an amazing guy. He's a cool author. Probably his views are more close to my views than anyone else's that we interviewed in this series. But honestly, that's not the most important thing for me. I was hoping in the Steve Keen interview today that he was going to tell me that his goal with this book was to influence central bank policy. And he was going to go through the whole process of essentially taking his own prescriptions for how to fix this, publish it in a book, subject it to the peer review process, and maybe eventually make a difference. I think he's probably right to have given up hope, but it's still disheartening for me to hear that because, you know, he's actually got the academic credentials where he could be taken seriously. He's also got the card to play of being one of very, very few people who saw 2008 coming and accurately predicted it. So I would love to see a guy like that who might actually be able to change things. I think he has realistically given up on things changing and, you know, he's off doing other stuff. So I thought they were all great interviews, but I thought it was most interesting that, you know, what I look for from these is not for somebody to agree with me, but to give me insight into what I can expect to come next from policymakers.
Well, you guys, Macro Voices is 3 months old today, and thanks to your support, we've really been starting to get some traction. So I feel it's time to open the proverbial kimono and tell our listeners a little bit more about our plans for the Macro Voices project. Eric?
Well, Macro Voices has never been just about the podcast. From day one, what Nathan and I have envisioned is to create a global network of sophisticated investors who collaborate, share investing ideas, and make personal connections with other interesting people online all over the world. That's what this project has always been all about for us. Our concept of how to achieve that was to launch the podcast and our listener discussion forums at the same time. The whole idea was that a podcast centered around a featured interview guest every week would be the perfect way to get the conversation started. And then our listener discussion forums would be the place where all of us would come together and continue the discussion that began with the guest interview in the podcast.
And your thoughts on how it's going so far with this approach?
Well, the podcast itself has been getting fantastic traction. Our download counts are skyrocketing, and we've experienced an almost unanimous positive feedback. The listener discussion forums were never expected to achieve critical mass for at least the first 6 months, so it's still early to say. But I've certainly noticed a huge pickup in interesting exchanges between some very knowledgeable listeners in the last 3 weeks. So it's a chicken and egg problem. When we get enough smart, interesting people participating, that by itself will draw in more smart, interesting people, and it becomes a self-reinforcing virtuous cycle. My talk radio mentors tell me 6 months is the bare minimum to achieve traction and gain a regular audience. So we seem to be already experiencing a pickup in interest in the forum, so I guess we're ahead of schedule.
Plenty of ups and downs, and we've learned quite a lot in these last 3 months, and that's led us to make some changes that we're going to announce this week. Eric, let's start with how things have gone and where we think that we can improve.
Well, the listener discussion forums are gaining traction. I expect them to be successful. But frankly, as a former software entrepreneur, I am ashamed of myself to admit that I had absolutely no clue how much investment-related value exists on Twitter. Our Macro Voices podcasts are actually being discussed and debated more actively on Twitter than in our own listener discussion forums, and that really got our attention. When we look at what a tiny percentage of our listeners are actually registering and participating in the discussion forums, it's just obvious. Threaded discussion forums are not for everyone, so maybe I'm dating myself by thinking that that was the way to make this happen. I don't really think, though, that Twitter is the end-all answer either. It's fantastically well-suited to day traders and maybe swing traders who are sharing charts and news items and even some friendly banter among a community of traders who all know one another from their online presence. And it's super cool. I'm very excited to continue to participate in this community myself. But Macro Voices isn't meant to be about day trading or swing trading, where it's easy to fit your whole idea into 140 characters or less. We're here to provoke and encourage thoughtful, detailed, intellectual discourse about the issues of the day in the global economy. In my opinion, Twitter is not nearly as well suited to that objective as it is, let's say, to something like day traders sharing opinions on support and resistance levels.
So since constant improvement is, in fact, our mantra, what do we want to do next in pursuit of our end goal of creating that global community of sophisticated investors who are willing to collaborate rather than compete and share ideas online?
We're making two changes today to address this problem. The first is that we could do a better job of sharing all of the cool stuff that we've been receiving as a result of this project. Perfect example. Our listeners loved the way Art Berman was so kind as to provide a PowerPoint presentation full of graphs and charts to back up what he said in his interview on the program. Well, guess what, folks? I've received two more really cool chart books from Art since that interview. I've got them and you don't. That's not right. We got to fix that. So starting with today's show, we're going to email all of our registered users a new newsletter that we're calling the Macro Voices Research Roundup. This is going to be a very simple, straightforward list of links to the coolest free stuff that we could find on the internet or from our past show guests in any particular week. It will never, I say again, never include any marketing or sales content from us or anyone else, period. We're very committed to that. We invite our featured guests to send us new stuff. If Art's got a new book of charts or Rick Rule wants to send us information about something that he's doing, we want to be able to keep you up to date on that. So this email blast that we're going to send out will be the mechanism to send you all the cool information that we receive here at Macro Voices. We also want you, our listeners, to feel free to send us cool stuff that you think other listeners would enjoy, provided that it's in the public domain and that we can redistribute it without any intellectual property issues. But I need to be crystal clear on this one point. We do not want to spam anyone, and we will reject anything that even remotely smells like marketing or advertising. So please, don't take offense if we don't use something that you send us, even if it's really great content that might be of interest. If we think it has any risk whatsoever of feeling to our listeners like we're sending them sales pitches, we're just not going to run it. Frankly, we also don't have enough time to be able to process everything completely. So please don't be offended if we don't use information that you send us. I have to be super clear, too. We never want to spam or offend anybody. I can't imagine why anybody listening would not want this free research. But if you don't, there's a safe unsubscribe link at the bottom that will instantly and permanently take you off the Research Roundup mailing list.
So listeners who want to submit public domain content for consideration in this newsletter should email researchroundup@macrovoices.com. And I also want to let everyone know that I'm going to do my best to send these Research Roundup emails out whenever we get really great content to share with you, but please understand that Macro Voices is a part-time job, for me at least, and frankly, we haven't yet decided how frequently we should send these things out. We're going to play it by ear. So the frequency may be sporadic at first as we experiment to see what works for our listeners. Please bear with us while we figure out how to best execute this idea. Eric, you said there were two things we had to announce today. What's the second one?
This is the one that we're really excited about. Now, keep in mind here, the goal, again, is to create a global network of sophisticated investors who collaborate and share ideas online. You've heard me talk a lot on this program about Samir Madani, who goes by the name Sam, by the way. Sam is a sales executive for a Swedish internet router company by day, but his passionate hobby is doing deep research on how many crude oil tankers are waiting to get into port, because that knowledge translates directly into Trading Edge. Sam can front-run those EIA inventory reports because he's watching the ships and knows exactly what's going on. Sam publishes all of his research absolutely free of charge to anybody who wants it because he's as passionate as I am about the idea of collaborating with other smart people and sharing research and investment ideas with them online. Now, that's exactly the kind of guy that I feel most passionate about helping. Sure, someday this program is going to be big enough that we'll be able to get big-name guests like Stan Druckenmiller and Kyle Bass and Hugh Hendry, and I certainly look forward to that day. But frankly, if there is one place where I feel that we can truly make the investing world a better place through our actions with this podcast, it's by seeking out, finding, and helping guys like Sam to promote what they're doing and to connect with other sophisticated investors around the globe. So here's what we're going to do. The central focus of this show will always center on a long-form feature interview with a guest who's somebody of notoriety in the field, somebody relatively famous. That's the same. It's not going to change. It's exactly the same as what we've been doing from day one. But when we come across a guy like Sam, who really has something of value that he's willing to share with other investors and has nothing to sell or promote beyond what he wants to just give away for free, we're going to just plain make time in the schedule to accommodate a brief 10-minute interview with a guy like that, to introduce you to that person, tell you where you can learn more about their work, and so on. So the whole idea is to both discover guys like Sam and help them to promote what they're doing, and also, frankly, to inspire other people. We've got lots of smart private investors that do a lot of research for their own investments. I'm trying to inspire you guys to learn the value of doing this the way Sam does it, which is share your research with other investors online and benefit from what you get back from creating a community. Going forward, we can only allocate 10 minutes to this because of time constraints, but we managed to carve out just a couple of extra minutes this week for Sam because we really think his project is worthy of your attention.
And that interview with Sam is coming up next right here at macrovoices.com.
Sam, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Let's start with hashtag OOTT. What does it stand for and how did it come about?
Right. Thank you for having me. The hashtag OOTT stands for hashtag Organization of Oil Trading Tweeters. And the way it came about was basically that I spend a lot of time on Twitter looking for news in the world of oil. And I'm very interested in oil as a sector, oil is an economy, oil is a market. And what really was difficult was collecting all this information and finding people who have similar interests. So I figured I would start something by pulling everyone in as a hub under a separate hashtag, which was not hashtag oil, but hashtag OOTT. And sure enough, now we have a lot of people from all over the world, in different walks of life, different professions. They're all using this hashtag when they have anything oil related to tweet about. And what you can do is once a day, twice a day, just click on that hashtag and you get a long list of interesting topics and news related to oil. So it's a very, it's almost as if it's centralized, but it's decentralized in the form of a peer-to-peer network.
Now, normally I'd ask you to go into what kind of work you do yourself for hashtag OOTT. But this week, you just produced a fantastic Periscope video, almost 2 hours long. We've already emailed a link to that video to our registered users through our new Research Roundup email blast. Anybody else who wants it can find it by following you at Samir Madani on Twitter. Just give us a real quick idea of what people are going to find in that video, and then I want to move on from there.
Right. The Periscope video is something I've been meaning to put together for some time now. What it covers is, firstly, a brief explanation of what OOTT is. And then I gave a virtual tour of the world where I showed the interesting storage sites and facilities and ports for oil. And sure enough, it varies so much country to country. And we first started off with Japan, which is actually the most interesting and innovative place for storing oil because they do it offshore. They do it out in the water, and that's because of the landscape and because of the fact that there's earthquakes and tsunamis and what have you. So they have a very unique and very innovative storage solution versus some other countries which have very impromptu setups and others, of course, which use on land storage, which obviously takes up a lot of space. And then we went into the characteristics of various vessels, fleets, which I track. And in my database, I'm tracking close to 500 supertankers from all over the world, or not all over the world. It's about 10 different countries. They're the top producers and top buyers of oil. And they account for about 578 million barrels, which I'm tracking daily. So I gave them a nice tour through Periscope on that. And then obviously also what I do daily, and that is the Houston reports and Loop, Louisiana offshore oil port report. So I put together this report daily, every night here in Stockholm. And for those of you in the U.S., you get it sometime during the late afternoon. And you can see what has moved in and out of Houston and the Loop in terms of the volume of barrels.
And that video basically allows people to effectively look over your shoulder and see what you're doing and how you do what you do. And I think it's really fascinating. It is a long one, but a very interesting one. But hang on a second, Sam, because you are a Kuwaiti-born Jordanian of Saudi Arabian and Croatian ancestry, living in Stockholm, Sweden, working as a sales executive for an internet router company that you co-founded. You're also the father of two young children. But somehow you make time for this passionate hobby, and you choose to share this fantastic wealth of information completely for free with anybody who wants it through your Twitter account. Now, I think there's maybe just a little bit of a personal interest story here. So what makes Sam tick? And particularly, why would you put so much work into something and then give it away for free? What do you get out of all this?
This is a very good question. I really appreciate that you asked. I have to look at it as a you know, like a dice, a cube. And there are many different facets which are of interest for me. And when I came to this oil table not too long ago, I mean, I'm an enthusiast, a hobbyist. I started off basically around somewhere around 7 months ago. And I felt that I have most of the sides of this cube covered because I have an in-depth knowledge of geopolitics, of culture, linguistics, and other things around oil, which are mostly what we don't see. Yeah, because all we see on our screens are the graphs and the headlines and so on. But I know how the negotiations take place because I understand those cultures within OPEC, between Russia and OPEC and so on. So I was able to forecast, predict some conclusions to some of the events that have been going on within all these discussions. I saw these breakdowns coming miles away. And what I really wanted to learn more about was the actual oil as a sector, how it works, the logistics behind it, because I'm very much, I have daily work with logistics. So I've been tracking vessels previous to oil, my own shipments of routers and so on. And what I figured was when I heard about all this regarding the oil glut worldwide, I said, I have to look at that. So I went to marinetraffic.com. I fired up my profile there and I clicked on the filter called tankers. And sure enough, my screen just went red. I mean, there was tankers everywhere. And I zoomed in on many different ports, and I had to Google up all the list of the top ports around the world. And I started building up databases on various fleets. And the easiest fleet I was able to find was the Iranian one, because they were blacklisted several years ago, obviously because of the sanctions. And so there was a very, very well detailed list of tankers. And I imported that into the database, and I can see where they are now in real time. And it's amazing because 2/5 of that fleet is incapacitated. It is just stuck off the port of Assyria as storage, containing 50.5 million barrels at this speaking moment.
So I see how you got into all this fascinating research, and I see how it gives you tremendous trading edge as a trader. What makes you feel inspired, though, to give it away for free? And what do you get out of the relationships that you've built as a result of doing so?
What you get out of something like this, really, there's no economic incentive for me to start charging anyone for this, because I feel like I'm only contributing. I'm just one cogwheel in this giant clock here. And if we all work together, traders, people who, I mean, honestly, the hashtag OOTT is comprised of people that work within everything within oil. And you have people who have worked down at the docks, people who worked at ports, people who trade it. They've never even touched the liquid, obviously. And bring them all together under one hashtag, and we all exchanging ideas, news, and views. And I find that amazing. And this only started about just a little over 2 weeks ago. And the way it happened was I felt that I had just a very small glimpse of what's happening, and that's Pad 3, the Gulf of Mexico. And I was monitoring Houston and Loop, and that accounts for maybe, what, a third of all the oil intake into the U.S. And I said, I need more coverage here, so I need to start seeking volunteers. And I started posting up tweets on Twitter asking for volunteers. And then all of a sudden, I'm getting people who are volunteering to follow tankers, others who are willing to follow weather, others who are willing to follow news and events and start logging all that stuff. So we started logging. And how do different people start logging things? So we all set up our own spreadsheets with Google Docs, Excel sheets. And sure enough, you have people editing them daily. And if you look at the top right, you'll see so many spectators 24/7 who are in those spreadsheets. And they're finding out so much regarding oil in real time. So real-time events, real-time updates on tankers, and it's just amazing. And the best thing out of it is this network that you build of contacts, people who share these interests with you. And we're all learning from each other. That's the best thing. So it gives me great joy to learn every day something new from these people.
So maybe to put it another way, everybody knows that individual investors have a huge disadvantage over something like, let's say, a hedge fund with a research staff of 30 or 40 people. What you're doing is you're basically turning the tables of that and saying, no, we can have a research staff of 30 or 40 people who just choose to voluntarily collaborate with each other and all benefit from each other's research and ideas. And you guys all get not only that benefit, but you also take something being an individual investor, which is very isolating and not socially interesting. And all of a sudden, you have a whole network of friends all over the world that you're working and collaborating with, and it all supports your investments. So I just really want to applaud you for the leadership that you've shown in doing this.
Thank you very much. I mean, this is the power of the internet.
And, you know, I think it's so important, too, for people to understand. I think there's a culture in finance and investing of secrecy that just doesn't make sense. It is absolutely true. If you're Warren Buffett or you're George Soros, you can't say what's on your mind because people will steal your ideas and front run you. We just don't have that problem. Individual investors don't have it. I'm a hedge fund manager, but I'm a small-time hedge fund manager. The fact that I say something is not, and I share information or tell people what trades I'm in, is not going to cost me anything. I don't have the problem of being Warren Buffett. And I think so many people let their egos get in the way and they fail to see the opportunity that's out there from collaboration with all these fantastic tools we have on the internet. So I just think that it's wonderful what you're doing. I want to thank you for your leadership, and I really want to speak to other people. I know for sure that we have a lot of other investors listening to this program regularly who do just as much interesting research in support of their own investments as Sam has done. Think about sharing it with other people the way Sam has done it. He gets a lot of benefit that you can't get without sharing. Try it. It's worth it. Sam, anything you want to add? We've only got about a half a minute before we have to wrap this up.
Yes, the only thing I want to add is everyone can contribute. And the simplest way to do it is if you have something of importance or something you feel like you want to get out there in regards to oil, any news, any figures, anything possible, just put a hashtag OOTT and everyone will be able to spot that within seconds. Thank you very much.
Sam, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I'm super excited to kick off this new format with Sameer Madani, who we truly feel shares our vision for collaboration, as Eric mentioned, and we definitely welcome feedback from our listeners on everything we've announced today. So if you know of other people who are not selling or promoting anything but are doing work as interesting as that which Sam was kind enough to share with us today, please email me directly at nathan@macrovoices.com to recommend them as a future guest for this new 10-minute segment. And now as we close, I also want to remind listeners that while we do this show for free and we never want to monetize it in any way, you should remember that you can still very much support the program in a massive way by rating and reviewing us on iTunes. If you just open your iTunes, and if you're not already subscribed to Macro Voices, please do so, then right-click on the Macro Voices logo and select Show in iTunes Store from the drop-down menu. Then immediately to the right of the Macro Voices logo, click Ratings and Reviews, and under the heading Customer Ratings, where it says click to rate, we hope you'll be inspired to give us 5 stars, but all honest feedback is good feedback. So then there's another heading, Customer Reviews, and you can click Write a Review button, and you'll be taken to a page that allows you to share your opinions with other iTunes users. And to this point, we've received loads of emails and posts in our forums with really kind words, and we certainly value and appreciate this feedback. But placing that same feedback in the review section on iTunes increases our visibility and our presence in the iTunes podcast directories. So that's going to really help us continue to expand our audience. You can also follow us on Twitter at Macro Voices, and Mr. Townsend is more and more active by the day. So if you want to follow his personal handle, you can do so at ERIKS Townsend. If Twitter isn't quite your gig, but you'd like to continue the discussion of topics covered on the show, I encourage you to come join us in our forums at macrovoices.com/forums. We hope to have you back next week when Jeff Christian of CPM Group will be our featured guest. For Eric Townsend, this is Nathan Egger, wishing you all a fantastic weekend. We'll see you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Nathan Egger, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.